We work in a very small lab, and there's really just two of us really working in the lab, so we don't quite have the facility everybody else does, but this is what we try to do. We try to determine the range of glycosidases and chitinases of phlebotomous papatase, which is our model in Israel. And we try to compare those enzyme activities from different colonies that we had, which were collected from diverse habitats. And then we try to compare these enzyme activities before and after sugar meals, and then determine the substrate specificity of these enzymes. We collected our sound flies, and we collected our samples from. So you can see the four places. The area called F1 star, that's Kfar Adumim. We collected two sites there. Kfar Adumim, in fact, is a tropical site. There's no there's lots of papatase in the houses, but they're not actually the vector. We collected from two areas in the Jordan River, one in the spring and one in the late summer, which we call the arid area, and I'll try and show you a photograph of that. And one in an oasis called Niota Kikar, which is a small Leishmania site, with lots of papatase. We also collected one way up in the north. It's another tropical site near the Sea of Galilee, but I'm not going to talk about that site too much. It's too much data for one thing. So these sites vary. The south of the Dead Sea, it's very low. It's below sea level. It's about 340 meters below sea level. Very hot, 38 degrees. And the important thing is that the reservoir there, which is San Momis, only about 10% are infected. Only about 10% are infected. In the Gilgal, in the Jordan Valley area, we get up to about 90% infected, and you can see the maximum temperature in the spring it's about 28 degrees, in the summer it can be as high as 42. And then this other side, the Kfar Adumim site, that's above sea level, and that's, there's no major there at all. Okay? Now, the reason that we sort of began to worry about this is, as Phil was saying earlier, suddenly we had no Leishmania in our sand flies. And that happened about 1996, and we desperately looked around for other sources of sand flies. It just continued to go down and down and down. And we had the feeling that too much sugar was one of the problems. So we took this colony from Kfar Adumim, which it was only about 10% susceptible to Leishmania. We starved them for 5 to 6 days. And then we fed them on blood, allowed them to oviposit, and then we infected the F1 generation. And amazed, we found, was that 64 to 86% were suddenly infected, when the original colony only had 10%. So this got us very excited. Well, some of us got excited. And so we began to look at some of the data we'd been collecting for some time. And when you go to the oasis site, that's the one in the south of the Dead Sea, nearly every single sandfly was in fact anthrone positive. Anthrone to test for sugar, they were all positive. In the arid site in the Jordan Valley, only about 25% of them were infected. Then we looked for starch inside the sandflies from the Jordan Valley, and we found many, many of the femurs had little starch granules inside them. And then so we compared what we had with the infected, so that the oasis site, 25% were infected, the papatase this time, about 75 to 80% in the arid site. The SARV ones, which is just a lab test, was about 50, 60, sometimes 70%. And if you just sugar fed your flies, just ordinary sucrose, you got really lousy results in our lab. And in fact, even the number of promastigotes you get in those flies varied. In the arid site, it was much higher than anywhere else. In the oasis site, they were absolutely hopeless. Okay, if you don't know very much about plants, they have lots of sugar in them. Some in the phloem is mainly sucrose. The extra floral nectars contain glucose and fructose and sucrose. The honeydews from the hemipteras, very complex, lots and lots of sugars in there. And some plant carbohydrates, their sugar polymers, again, fairly from arabinose all the way through to starch. This is the Phlebotomous papatase on caper. Caper plants are very common in the Jordan Valley. And they seem to crawl up, looking and looking and looking and looking, and then suddenly, even though they've got very, very light proboscis, they seem to be able to probe inside there. Fortunately, somebody put a finger on the original slide, and this is what I'm left with. There we go. These are extra floral nectaries. I don't know as entomologists you know anything about extra floral nectaries, but we discovered these recently as being a great source of sugar. This Russian is communist, the castor oil bean. You can see these where the arrows are. Oh, you can't see that, can you? Well, you can see the arrows, And we found that this is one of the common sources of sugar in the field for sandflies. This is the other source, and I stole these from the ARS. I hope they'll forgive me. I did give them credit. This is the mealybug, the manna mealybug, which is very common, and Tamarix jordanus is very common in the Jordan Valley, all on both sides of the Dead Sea area, and that's very very heavy sugar source for a lot of sandflies. And the other one, Icteropurchasi, that's a scaly insect, also leaves lots of sugar. If you try and take like a gorse bush, if it has no Icteropurchasi on it, the sandflies won't feed. You can get quite a few of them will feed if it has the honeydew from the percheri. I also found this, I don't know who Phil Pelletri is, but he did a lovely job of showing us just honeydew left on a leaf by an insect. Okay, this is where Kfar Damim is. It's a village about 15 kilometers east of Jerusalem. That's Jerusalem in the background. And this is the oasis site. You can see it's very rich, lots of date palms. The little village there, you can actually put out your traps, go back to the village, you know, have a few beers, and then first thing in the morning, collect your insects. Very popular for date palms there. There's Jordan in the background with the Dead Sea. Okay, this is what the real, what we call our arid site. In the spring, it's quite green. That's the one on the left. Is it on the left for you? Yeah, it's on the left for you. And it, by the summer, there's nothing there. That's a Tamarix jordanus tree in the background in the summer. Dry, almost no greenery around at all. And this is Semomys abyssus. We've been all talking about this. Is it actually in its natural habitat, the little holes? My wife made this slide for me, and I think it's rather gorgeous. In and out of the holes, they're only diurnally, they only come out in the daytime, so the sandflies feed at them on the nighttime. This is Atropix halimus. It's the most important place to find Semomys usually, but under these bushes, and the sandflies actually feed on it. How do I know this? Because we took sandflies, fed them only on Atropix, and you can see the little. Can I do it gently? I can't. You can see the little grains. You see those? Where the yellow arrow is, that's starch grains inside the gut. And what you can also find sometimes is actual pieces of cellulose, which you can stain with fluorescent brightener, inside the gut of the sandfly, and that's that little white thing on the left. Under phase, on the right, you can't see anything. Under the left, you can see with the yellow arrow, the white. I don't want to use the pointer because I have a feeling I'll just move on too fast. Okay, so what did we do? We took four, I'm going to talk about the four different groups. The ones from the oasis, the ones from, let's say, the end of summer, which we're calling the very arid area, ones in the spring that Marcelo might be interested in, and this is starved group, okay? The first thing we noticed was that the arid females were much heavier than any of the other sandflies, much, much heavier than any of the other sandflies, which was why they were heavier, why they were bigger. They maintained it over a two-year period. They always remained higher. We actually took, every 2 months, we took a group of flies and we froze them down so that we could compare them all at the same time. So over a two-year period, basically, we looked at all these different samples. So they were heavier than anything else. These are the sugars that we tried to look at. It's a long list. I don't really want to go through every single one of them, but these are the sugars. You can see them there, and I believe it's been recorded, so you can go back over it afterwards. We looked at some what we call metabolic enzymes, the chitinases, which is something we described a very long time ago, about 20 years ago now, I think. And the reason that we looked at guts rather than looking, sorry, the reason we looked at homogenase, whole body homogenase, rather than just actual guts, was because we had to do something like 10,000 sandflies altogether. And dissecting out guts over 10,000 sandflies was like almost impossibility for us. So we compared the results of the guts, and we found we were just losing activity. We just couldn't do it fast enough, just two of us. So we decided to go for the whole homogenase instead. But all these enzymes were present in the guts. I'm going to need a pointer now. It's going to get difficult. Okay. So you could see on these are the four sort of what we call the glucosidase enzymes. And you can see immediately that the yellow, which is the arid sandflies, I've tried to color code them so it make it easier for you. The yellow for arid, all right? You can see immediately that that's much, much higher than in the oasis, in the oasis group. Dare I use it? Really need a pointer, mate. think I'm going to use it. Oh, yes, okay. It's come up. So you can see it's much, much higher. What I feared. Okay. I'm almost going to stand out there and do it. So the glucoside, big differences. And then you look at sucrase and these starflies, which came from this long, about 4 or 5 years, only we fed a sucrase. They seem to have much more sucrase than any of the other flies. Amylase, very much the same in the female flies, very, very little difference. And amylase, as you know, is the enzyme for starch. And maltase, which almost all the same for all the females. Males, quite a bit of variation in the males, but the basic picture was that the starved ones were very high in glucosidase, and the Jordan Valley ones of males are very high in sucrase. I don't know why these are, but they're very specific differences. They are statistically different as well. Big variations. This is what one of our biggest problems is. Some of the groups, they stay consistent and tight over a year period. This is every 2 months, taking 100, 200 flies each time and estimating them. The groups stay the same. But the Jordan Valley flies, very variable over a whole year's period. But again, they were statistically much higher than in the other groups. The chitinase activity, which is one of the big contentions, do the flies use the chitinase to break down the pleiotrophic membrane and let the and if they don't have any chitinase, then do the leishmania actually help the sandfly break down? What we found was very interesting. The Neotachycar, the oasis fly, which are very poor vectors or very poor transmitters of leishmania, have very high N-acetyl beta hexaminase and very high chitinases, and against the Jordan Valley arid ones had virtually little, very, very little of these enzymes. It's as if the leishmania, which is the best vectors, have to help the sandfly, and they break the pleiotrophic membrane at the front, and therefore they're able to escape towards the proboscis. And the ones which are lousy vectors are in fact ones that have very much too much chitinase for the leishmania. The metabolic enzymes, you know, they're not very important to us today, I don't think. Big enzyme variation. Again, I'm showing you that the Jordan Valley flies and much more variation than in the other flies. Big changes when you feed them on a sugar meal. And the reason that this took us so long was because you feed flies or each of the different groups on sugar meals at the same time. Glucosidase goes down, sucrase goes up. Amylase stays about the same, maltase stays about the same. And some, for some variations, we just can't explain why. For instance, on the alpha fucosidase, the female goes down by 60% and the male goes up. If anybody's got an explanation for that, I'd be only happy to hear it. But these are repeat after repeat after repeat, and always you get the same result. So there's tremendous variation between these four different groups. The N-acetylated enzymes, again, we have hexaminase goes up after a sugar meal in most of the species, but not all of them, and the N-acetylgalactosaminidase goes down. Some people question whether there was any difference between alpha-glucosidase, sucrase, and maltase. I'm not really an enzymologist. I do this because I'm interested in sandflies and leishmania, and so we decided to do the proper job, which was do the KM, and we found immediately that the alpha-glucosidase, the sucrase, and the maltase were very different on the KMs, and even their pHs are different, where they maximize on the pH. Sucrase is about 4.8, maltase shifts a bit, and alpha-glucose even more towards the alkaline level. We tried to use enzymes to inhibit these sugars because it's the only way to know whether they're really functioning properly or not. And I have to explain that there are three types of inhibitors. There's the constant inhibition, that's the blue triangle, the dose-dependent one, which goes up, and then there's enzyme activation. Sometimes you get enzyme activation. So just some examples we found, for instance, for alpha-glucosidase, you get a very nice inhibition with a substance called erythritol, which is a sort of a synthetic glucose. Glucose, again, that does a nice job in sucrase. Against inositols, galactose, and lactose, hardly had any effect at all. Alpha-manosidase, we actually saw differences between the four groups with this, and quite extraordinary, the arid flies, after a very small amount of mannose was immediately inhibited at the 75% level, we kept on adding more manosidase, and mannose made absolutely no difference, and the others sort of gave us the nice properly dependent sign. Allosamidine is an inhibitor for chitinase, is very important, this basically the only one that anyone ever uses, and we find in fact that it did a wonderful job inhibiting the chitotriosidases, but hardly anything on the chitinases. And again, we did what the enzymologists insist we do, the VX and the KM, and the two very different enzymes. So there were significant differences between the arid and the oasis groups, between 10 and 17 of the females and 8 and 17 for the spring and 9 and 17 for the starved. The males weren't quite as different, but when I say significant differences, they really are p equals 0.005 over the numbers we use, because we use very large numbers. So the arid group is a totally different group. It's a wonderful vector, and it has totally different sugar amounts than anything else has. So our conclusions really were that the PEP hepatitis have a wide repertoire of functioning glycosidases. They vary according to the habitat. These glycosidases are inhibited by the appropriate saccharides, and a whole family of chitinoses are expressed and fully functional in the sandflies. Thank you for your attention.
We have time for some questions. After questions, we'll take a break. You have a question? Okay. So speak into the mic and repeat your questions.
Repeat the question.
This is great, Jacob. I have a question in regards to the chitinase in the Jordan Valley versus, I guess, the
oasis. Yeah.
So the analysis for the chitinolytic activity was done in the whole gut.
Absolutely. So whole homogenates.
Right. So and then if you look at the one being a good one being infected, usually infected, other not being infected. One possibility would be that it's certainly expressing more. And what it's doing is just destroying or permeating the matrix more quickly or much sooner before the parasites are actually promastigotes and resistant to the protease, and then they can be killed by the protease at that point.
That's what we think too. I mean, we just think that the chitinase is so high. Do you have to repeat that question? Because he's quite close to the microscope. It was a long question.
Go ahead. Yeah. Make question. The question short.
What do you think, too, that the chitinase? You can see on these Jordan Valley flies, the break is at the anterior end. And the Neotica flies, the oasis flies, the break always seems to be at the posterior end. So it's this very high chitinase level. If that's for me, can you tell them I'll ring them back in a minute?
Yeah,
okay. So that's what we think too. Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of experiments are done to verify the fly better or less biases in the laboratory. And
from the field as well. We're collecting many field flies.
Right. But what I'm wondering is, what would you suggest as a standard SOP when you're doing an experiment in the laboratory to say this fly is a vector or not?
Okay, so his question is, how do you define a vector in sandfly biology? That's what you're saying. They asked me to repeat the question. That's how I understood the question. I think the thing is, I shouldn't say that the oasis flies aren't vectors. They are vectors. They get about 10% are infected, and about 10% of the samomias that we collect are infected. So they can do the job, but they're nowhere near as efficient as the ones from the arid areas. And the arid areas vary from the spring ones. So what I should say is that too much sugar is not a good thing. All right? I think, in fact, at one time we even suggested using, and in fact, the Czech group now use what's called forest honey, because it contains many more things besides just pure sugar. Perhaps that stimulates the enzymes better for the Leishmania. They look like they're desperate for coffee, by the way.
So in the laboratory, if I wanted to incriminate a vector, I would not turn the sugar on it if I was doing the experiment. Otherwise, my experiment I might come up with a negative result, when in reality, it might be a potential vector.
Yeah, I think so. I think the sugar meal is one of the most ignored problems of sandfly biology that hardly anyone ever looks at them. And we've been looking very hard because it's, up our alleyway, And we have all the plants, we can collect them. But, I literally have Atroplex growing, 200 meters from the lab. So, that's why I could do this experiment. Okay, timing good?
Timing very good.
Okay, great. Okay.
Thank you very much.